Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 4th, 2018, and welcome to episode 165 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz? Will I ever find my way?
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, marketing, theme song discussions before we start recording, all kinds of things. So I'm here, I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined today by two other retro computing enthusiasts, one being Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I am Carrington Vanston in Toronto. In San Francisco, they call me Vicky. I'm doing well. How are you, Paul?
I'm all right. I'm recording on Super Bowl Sunday.
There will be riots.
There will, yeah. So the local team is one of the teams playing. And, of course, you're going to hear this, you know, a week after Boston was destroyed. But, yeah, apparently I have to finish fairly soon because they're going to lock down this area for fear of riots. So whether we win or lose, it's great. But okay, enough of me. Also, we have on the program Jack Nutting in Sweden. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm just sitting here thinking about whether I should try and stay up and watch the Super Bowl tonight. I know it is your local team, the Boston Baked Beans, versus the Georgia Falconeers, right? Is that right?
Something probably.
The Utah Chicken Hawks. Is that it? No, it's some bird. Mm. Anyway, I probably won't watch.
I don't actually know.
I think it's a bird, but I don't know. I'm not going to watch. Actually, I would watch if I were in the U.S. I typically did just because, but here it's so late at night. I sometimes watch anyway, but it's just tonight I can't. It's like because it's on until like 4 in the morning or something.
So, I'm not going to watch this year because I don't care, and that's the same reason I didn't watch last year.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know,
I get how other people can really dig it. Like, I don't think it's bad to really get into a sport or like it or whatever. It's just totally not my thing.
Yep.
Right. Exactly. That's pretty much where I was going with that too. Like I've never cared about the sport anyway, so I don't care about this particularly. I will occasionally watch it for the ads, but I mean, even then it's like, yeah, it's just not worth wasting that time.
Mm. Plus all those ads appear later. Like there'll always be some sort of compilation online. Like here are the best Super Bowl ads.
Right.
That's true. I was going to say that that consolation prize of being able to see all these ridiculously expensive ads, I don't even get that here because they don't show those ads here. So when the Super Bowl is on in Sweden or any other country, I presume, they show local ads because, you know, no one in the U.S. is paying their ad, you know, is paying to show their ad elsewhere in the world. So
same thing here in Canada. In Toronto, if you watch it, then it gets shown on a local station that sells its ad times. And so you see local Toronto ads or Canadian ads.
Yep.
So don't see the fancy American ones at anyway.
Crazy.
Yeah. There have been sort of big memorable ads. I remember, I mean, also the Mac ad, right? The 1984 ad was a Super Bowl ad. And there was one, I can't remember if it was Coke or Pepsi, but there was one that was in 3D. Ah. That was sort of a big thing. You could get glasses and everybody knew it was going to come. And it was basically a 3D effect that you got by sort of dimming. You have sort of like a sunglass lens on one eye, which somehow delays your visual processing and gives you a kind of depth perception if things are moving horizontally. So
I didn't know about that technique.
Yeah.
This is in the '80s, cool. Right, Paul?
Yeah.
I remember this because I remember they had the whole halftime show was with that also. And I remember this because specifically because I actually recorded the halftime episode on videotape because I wanted to see if the effect would actually stick and still kind of work. And it did.
Ooh, I mean, science.
To the extent that it worked at all, which was pretty yes. minimal, it still worked even playing off of a VHS tape. So.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that, though. I remember that when there were many times when I was a kid, there would be some event that's going to be in 3D, though usually it was in the with the red and blue glasses.
Right.
And you would get those, go down to a convenience store, and you get the red and blue glasses, and then when they were going to show, Metal Storm, the destruction of Jared Sin or whatever, like one of those 3D movies, that you could watch it in real 3D, and it was terrible.
Yeah.
And this sort of dimming thing is really actually quite cool, though, because it's still, you know, everything can still be in color. And it's surprisingly effective, actually. It's worth, all you have to do is just get a pair of sunglasses and just, you know, sort of hold them sideways so you're covering just one eye and then watch this thing going horizontally. And it really does kind of work. So I did a kind of an experiment as a kid possibly inspired by this. I don't know. I basically just had my, a parent or somebody drive me around while I held a video camera out the window and just sort of, so I have this, a lot of kind of horizontally moving, images of my neighborhood when I was a kid. And the purpose of that was so you could watch it this way. And it looks pretty 3D. The houses are kind of passing in front of the trees and things. It's pretty cool.
Cool.
All right.
I think that was the host topic.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say the host topic that I was in order to kind of be topical in some way, I thought maybe marketing, given the expensive Super Bowl ads that people pay for, might be something we could talk about, computer marketing. And if you remember any sort of computer advertisements, I was thinking when I was putting, trying to think about what I would even say, that I do remember some computer commercial, like computer television ads. Although I think that there were a lot more. It's possible that the ads that sort of got to me more were the ones that were in computer magazines that were, already focused on those. But the other thing I was kind of wondering about was whether computer ads are generally targeted at kids at that, in that point. Because it sure felt like it, but it could be that I was a kid looking at what kids saw.
Right. So,
and I'm not sure that any of you could help me with this because we're all about the same age. But
like, I would say that back in those days, in the early 80s, I don't remember seeing a lot of commercials, like TV commercials for computers. Like most of the ones that we've talked about and used on the show, with these old ads with Bill Bixby and, I don't remember those from the time at all. Like I'm sure I first saw those years and years and years later. But I do remember some video game ads. Like I remember several Atari video game ads, and I remember the Intellivision ads with George Plimpton. Probably just because he was so distinctive, it seemed to me, I didn't know who he was. It just seemed like, why do they have this English guy doing ads for this video game? It just seemed like it didn't make any sense to me. And so it was sort of stuck out. But I don't remember seeing TV commercials for computers much at all. And I wonder if that may be partly because of just like where I grew up, sort of out in the boonies, southern Minnesota, very much like a down market area, that probably the people who were spending money on commercials for more expensive things were probably mostly spending that money in city ads.
Right.
That's my guess, but I don't really know.
But were you in the Twin Cities media area?
No.
Or not?
No, not at all.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, we couldn't pick up any Twin Cities stations at all. We're too far away.
Okay. So. Yeah. Because I was, I'll come back to this like way at the end, but Minneapolis-St. Paul itself was actually a pretty techie area. But I also don't remember seeing, I guess probably they're just, it wasn't for the public yet, really. But all these ads that we pick for these little bits in the podcast they really do seem like they're kind of targeted at either parents saying your kid will be improved by having this, or, to kids saying, bother your parents to get this.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that sort of focus on the home computer as being something that would be good for children. And I think it's probably because adults at the time didn't have any concept of what they would do with a computer. and kids at least thought about playing games and that sort of thing. But like the area of using a computer for any sort of, you know, personal finances or useful activities that adults might like to do, most of these application areas are things that people had barely thought of yet. You know, and especially among the general public, people just didn't know about what you could do with a computer in general. So it kind of makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know. How are the Canadian ads?
I don't remember seeing a lot of them either. And I think because as a kid, maybe I was just watching stuff where they wouldn't advertise computers because those were really expensive things for adults or whatever. But like Jack, I remember a lot of ads for video games and things like the Atari 2600 and Intellivision and ColecoVision. And those were advertised in things I was watching, I guess because I was age appropriate. So they were really going after the kids to get them to convince the parents to buy them for Christmas or whatever. When I got older or in high school and stuff, I remember more recent computer ads or ad campaigns like the Think Different one and the Mac versus PC one. One of the early ones I recall though is the IBM PC series with the Charlie Chaplin guy, the pretending to be Charlie Chaplin. And I was very much a Mac person by then, so I was quite dismissive of IBM. Oh, big IBM, you're so terrible. I'm so cool with my mouse and all, whatever. But I remember those, so they made an impact on me. So those were at least advertised heavily in things I was watching, I guess. Right. But in trying to think of ads that I remember, computer ads that influenced me, it was hard to think of any of them. One story I can share, though, is briefly, like when I was a kid, my family owned a company called Valpak, which still exists, but we have nothing to do with it, not for many, many, many years. It's like a coupon company. We started it, like the Canadian end of it, in I think 1982, and it already existed under the same name. We both, there's a Valpak in the States, Valpak in Canada. Both of us had ripped the name off a third Valpak. So way to go, mom and dad. Like nobody can come up with a better name than Valpak. Okay. So a guy named Terry Label owned it in Florida, and he was like the Valpak down there since like the 70s or something. And then I think 82, we started in Canada. And then Terry Label bought half of the Canadian ones. So he was our partner. And then in 1985, we re-bought him out, bought the rest of Canada, and then bought out the States. And then we owned it until like 91 or 92 or something and sold it to Cox Communications. But anyway, so basically the period from 1982 to, say, 1992, my family owned a bunch of printing companies and did a bunch of Valpak coupons and things. And in 1987, I had a meeting with the people from Quark, because I never heard of them before, and they were coming out with Quark Express, and I had to go into work on my birthday. So it was March 24th is when I had a meeting with people from Quark, who assumed, of course, they were meeting with like a big fancy tech person, and in strolls, this snotty 18-year-old or whatever. So I'm like, I'm the guy in charge of tech here. So they're like, but this was also early. We had set up some computers, and like there wasn't really a lot of technology there. We were still using paste-up machines. So these big machines that you typeset things, so you print it all out and then cut everything, and like you print out the little bits of your coupons, put them in on a pasteboard, like literally paste them down, and it would take a photograph of them that would then make a plate, and you'd print. Like super old-fashioned tech. Mm-hmm. So Quark met with me because they were coming out with a thing called Quark Express, and it's going to be desktop publishing. It's going to be super hot. It's going to be amazing. And we had toyed with the idea of doing some sort of computerized desktop publishing, and we bought a bunch of Macs in anticipation of that. I think we bought like three of them or something, but we hadn't picked any software. We didn't really know what we were doing. And so I met with these people from Quark because they were going to do a series of ads talking about Quark Express. So we do TV ads, bunch of marketing splashes and print ads. And so they pitched us on, hey, would we adopt Quark? And if we did, then we could be a featured company in a bunch of Quark ads. And I said, well, that sounds interesting. And so in return, we would get free licenses for Quark for a year or something. So I met with them. They set up a TV studio. I had to go in and do a whole bunch of, they filmed me a bunch of times, and I did print interviews and all this. But I was, if you think I'm irreverent now, imagine an 18-year-old me. And so they kept doing retake after retake and saying, no, you can't say that. And I would just I mean, just embarrassingly ridiculous things. Like just anyway, the whole thing is very embarrassing. So in the end, they didn't use me at all, but but I came up, but I was good at coding. And so I looked at the software and I wrote, we were going to use a RIP, a raster image processor, and you could like print out, basically Quark was supposed to let us skip the stage of the paste up. So you'd have that and you take it into the dark room, photograph your stuff, and then make a plate from it. And I thought, well, what, can't I just skip all of that and we'll just print directly to film? There must be film printers. And so I brought in film printers. I'm like, well, hold on. There's this new paper plate stuff. Why don't we skip all of those departments and just print directly to the plates and just skip? Let's put everybody out of business. Fire. But we did. Like, we just, everybody, suddenly the darkroom people, we told them, you're going to learn to use Quark. Everybody is going on the computer. No more darkroom. So I just came up with the whole direct to plate thing. And the Quark people loved it. They said, oh, okay, we're maybe not going to do these ads, but we want to feature your software instead. And so they bought us a ton of computers and gave us software. They gave us, I think, a 5-year license for the software on unlimited computers in return for being licensing from us the direct-to-plate stuff. So if people basically up to 1990 were using Quark and all the direct-to-plate plugins, if you look in the about, they were all written by me, and it was all licensed by me, and it was my software, and so that was printed in some ads, but I never got to get named. They just talked about the neat Bell-Pack direct-to-plate stuff and left the 18-year-old off the ads. So that's kind of my when I think of like advertising for computers, that was the one that had the most impact on me in a sense, and a major lost opportunity because I just couldn't, you know, take it seriously and not be a total dill hole. So. Life with Carrington. So there you go. Quark. And they, one of the reasons they gave it to us, I think, is because after we met with them, then people from Aldus came over and said, oh, welcome to 1987. We're also coming out with stuff. And Quark was like, no, we're launching now. We're launching in like 2 weeks. And Aldus said, oh, we're going to be launching really, really soon. But I think Aldus didn't come out till like June or July. And we switched over in I think, April. Uh-huh. Quark came out like late March of 1987. And we were using it like 2 weeks later because, you know, nothing like leaping on version 1.0. And we like shut down on a Friday and we went direct to plate on the Monday. We said, we're going to set up over the weekend. Oh, it'll work. It'll work fine. It did not work fine. So there's some difficult times in switching over, but it, you know, took like a week to sort it out or whatever. And then we were doing, you know, tens of millions of coupons a month on direct to plate stuff. So it was cool tech. But super early adopting. Anyway, commercials. There you go. Commercials, yeah. For Quark.
That's, well, yeah. So I'm, that wasn't exactly what I had been anticipating when I put this host topic down, but I'm glad that that's where it ended.
it's the only thing I can think of.
That's pretty excellent. I'll have to see if I can find you in the about box somewhere. So I just, I suppose they didn't give you the video of you.
No, and in fact, they never even put anything together. All they did was we had a bunch of sessions. I think three times we got together in a little room, and they put the lights on me and had makeup on me, which made me feel like an idiot. I didn't realize you look terrible if you don't put makeup on. Right. It was the first time in front of me. I'm like, why are you putting makeup all over me? I'm gonna look like a girl. Ooh. I was such an idiot as a child. No, I'm much better now.
Yeah, right.
I'll be much better now.
All right, that seems like a good place to close the host's topic, but if you want to write in with your stories about being the impact of advertising on you, I will sit in the ruins of Boston and read them. But okay, so there's only a couple of listener feedback things I was going to mention. Mark on Twitter sent us a link to a pretty interesting page. I feel like, I don't know if I've seen this before or not. It's not new. It's dated February 2011. But it's kind of an interesting sort of overview of system fonts for 8-bit machines. So just sort of looking over the different the typefaces that Atari used and Apple used and Commodore used and the PET and the BBC Micro. And it's funny, actually, you know, like, they all do communicate a kind of a character. Like I look at them and I recognize that, like, oh, I see what that computer is. So it's kind of fun to look through. Anyway, if you want to just kind of be reminded of the personalities of these computers. And then the other one we got was a question over email. I'm not completely sure how serious this was, but Andrew asked whether the first LAN in Australia was called the LAN Down Under.
I hope it was. I absolutely hope it was.
Yeah. Yeah, a definite missed opportunity if it... I don't even know what that means, you know, the first LAN, but anyway, so we'll ask Michael next time. Okay, that'll do for listener feedback. We can actually move on to the items of interest and news. And Carrington, you have the first one.
I have the first one? Oh, I do, yes. Okay, so a fellow named David Kelly works for and worked for, I guess he was actually the founder of a company called IDEO or IDEO. Mm-hmm. And he and a team were the people who designed the first Apple mouse. Now, Apple, I think, was designing mice in-house, but they couldn't get one, according to this anyway, that was like cheap enough and could be reproduced and be robust enough and like cut their costs down. Like they couldn't quite get it. And so they hired this company, IDEO, to actually design the first Apple mouse. And there's a video on the IDEO site that just came out, which is the life of David Kelly according to his shelves. And at first I was going to brush this off. I thought, this isn't worth really talking about. It's just some guy who designed a mouse. I mean, more than I ever did, but he designed a mouse, you know, 40 years ago. And it's just, it's his office layout. Why would that be interesting? The video is super interesting. This guy is fascinating, you know, very, you know, kind of a quirky creative person. And he talks about how, like, his mom would give him Christmas gifts, which were mostly like, she calls it shopping in the basement. She'll go in the basement and find like an old toy he had as a child, and that's what she'll send him for Christmas. Like, it's more about memories and stuff, and very interesting family. But it's a short video, maybe 3 or 4 minutes. And within 30 seconds, you're at the point where he pulls out the original prototype for the first Apple mouse. And so here it is kind of falling apart. And then talks about things like how, maybe you don't know, but the ball in the original prototype was from a roll-on deodorant. And so that's why he said, let's use that. And the cover that went over top of it was part of a butter dish. And I was like, okay, you know, you've got me hooked. Now you're telling me things I wasn't sure about. So really interesting. It's only 3 or 4 minutes. Definitely worth watching. So there's a lot of computer history stuff in it about the mouse and such. And then interesting things about how he surrounds himself in his office with bits of memorabilia that evoke emotions and nostalgia. And I think that might resonate with a lot of our listeners as well, because we have a lot of listeners who, unlike me, are collectors and they surround themselves with stuff. And this person, this David Kelly, has a very interesting approach to what he keeps and why and how he displays it and why he wants to have a whole bunch of things around him instead of just one or two, and how that means you have a bunch of emotions or what. It's just, you know, it's a little flaky, but it's interesting. And it might give somebody who has a big collection an idea of another way to display them, or reasons why you would keep multiples of something or what have you. So I took a lot more out of this video than I thought I was going to, and he's an interesting guy. So the link will be in the show notes.
Nice. Yeah, I was just thinking that perhaps this is rationalizations, you know, justifications for keeping all this junk. But cool. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to look at it, but it's David M. Kelly, as opposed to the David E. Kelly of L.A. McBeal.
Right, yeah, different David Kelly.
All right, Jack, you have the next thing here.
Yeah, so this is what we've talked about before. This is the annual Basic 10-Liner Contest. The challenge to create a game in some basic variant running on an 8-bit computer in at most 10 lines of code. And they have different categories. And we've done this in past years. This is, I think, the fifth or sixth year maybe of this?
Maybe. I think more. I think more. It's something like the seventh or eighth.
Yeah, but anyway, I think it's the seventh, yeah. So basically you can use any 8-bit computer system, any version of BASIC that runs on any of these. It should be something that works in an emulator, because they're not going to try and gather hardware for all the judges, that sort of thing. And there are a few categories that based on how many characters per logical line should be allowed in the basic program, whether it's 80, 120, or 256. So, and these are always fun to look at. I've still never submitted anything. It's always fun to look at and see just like how terse and unreadable people can make their basic programs in 10 mm-hmm. lines, and how much they can get done in 10 lines of basic code.
I'm always very impressed with that. Yeah. It's kind of intimidating, actually. I would like to enter this contest too, but then I just have these memories of these incredible things people have done in 10 lines. Right. I think, oh, well, I guess I can't compete.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's always fun to look at. One new category they have this year is they have the free category. So in the past, they've always had rules about that all of the content of your basic, these 10 lines has to be basic code. So you couldn't use any tricks that would let you run machine language stored within the basic code. So like, I don't know about what other platforms, but like an Atari basic, you can have a string that is just like full of ASCII stuff that looks like garbage. If you type it in correctly, then you can actually tell basic, hey, just jump to this address, run the code at this address. You can actually have an assembly language program inside of a basic string and run it from in basic. And this is a common technique for doing things where you wanted to use basic for most of your code, but you wanted to have one thing be really tight because there was a performance critical section. You could make that part be in assembly language or in machine language. And now there's a category free in this that allows that. So kind of interesting. It means if you have a small program you've written in assembly, you could just sort of translate that into whatever format needs to run in your version of BASIC and probably do something a bit more that performs better. But again, like I said, what people have done with normal BASIC in 10 lines has been wildly mm-hmm. beyond whatever I would have imagined to begin with. So,
and friend of the show, Kevin Savitz, entered a couple last year, I think.
Kevin Savitz has entered a lot of these, I think. Yes.
Oh, yeah, because I know he did the Descend game, I'm remembering right. In particular. He did a version of that, I think in Turbo Basic or in something. So that was pretty impressive.
Yep, I know Kevin is a prolific 10-liner entry creator. So
yeah, it seems like it would be kind of fun to do. I've seen on one of these mailing lists that I'm on, there's been some discussions about how to do this. Because I guess in... I know this is true in the Apple II, like the AppleSoft version of the Microsoft BASIC, but there's no else. Actually, maybe it doesn't even matter that there's no else. There's no way to end an else block. So like in a single line, if you say if something, so in AppleSoft, if you say if something, then something, mm-hmm. You can't put anything else in that line because basically from then to the end of the line is only going to execute if the conditional is met. Mm-hmm. And I think some Microsoft BASICs actually do have else, but they have the same property that after else, you can't, you know, like there's no end.
Right.
So there's been some discussion about like ways that you can kind of get around that. I remember there was a magazine called Nibble that had these like two-liner contests. I think that was what I was thinking of, where, you know, like it was a similar kind of thing, except you're trying to get it all into two lines. And also there's a input buffer limitation. So if you type more than like 252 characters or something, it'll beep and fail. But I remember trying to come up with tricks with for next loops that would simulate go tos and, you know, thing and conditionals and things, but without actually leaving the line. Anyway, it's a lot of fun to try to do that stuff. So, but yet I don't think I'm gonna enter.
No,
I'm gonna look at what people do.
I know that a lot of people enter really cool games that use sprites. Like I'll look at the game and go, but how are you doing a version of Centipede in 10? What?
Oh, yeah.
And like we're at a major disadvantage, I think, on the Apple II platform. I don't think the Apple II platform performs as well in the rankings for these things. It seems to be mostly like Ataris and C64s and maybe the MSX or something.
Well, right. Yeah. If you can just say like, put this sprite at this point, you know, by three commands. And actually maybe you can use, I wonder if you could make your characters in your game be based on sprites that are drawn from memory and ROM, you know.
Oh my goodness.
Then you don't even need to put in your characters. But
the zero line basic.
Yeah, you're right. So I guess I have the next thing. Now this is it's been around for a little bit. It's a Patreon project called TXDJ is creating vintage computer videos, and some of us know this person. This is Justin Scott. Who is a frequent attendee, I think, he's at Kansas Fest a lot, and I think he also goes to the VCF events, VCF East and stuff, but he's got a sort of series of videos that he's putting together, kind of basically talking about vintage computer stuff, but he himself is kind of focused on communications and modems and things like that. He has some things that are available only to patrons, but there's a kind of a nice introduction that he's got, a frequently asked question video called How I Use Modems with Telnet for BBSing. And It's pretty in depth, and it kind of goes through a lot of modem technology and shows a bunch of the things that he has. But it's pretty neat. So if you have not come across that, it's worth at least watching the FAQ video and considering the Patreon project as well. I haven't really been keeping up with it too much, but it looks promising. Have either of you seen this before?
I have not, but I'm very interested.
Yeah, definitely watch the FAQ video. That's interesting. I'm looking at the Patreon page, and I see a YouTube link for a Haystack Smart Modem and the Apple II Plus with a YouTube video thumbnail that looks like the ones that you see when YouTube has removed it for content violation. So I wonder what happened there. YouTube, man, YouTube has some pretty aggressive algorithms for dinging people's videos, though.
Mm-hmm. And lately, some pretty controversial ones.
Yeah. Well. Anyway, yeah, take a look at that if you have a chance. It's pretty cool. Okay, we'll move on to the next one. Carrington.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
Would you like to tell us about the next thing?
Retro compute. Yes. Something got uploaded to archive.org, which is claiming to be a first. Not first thing to be uploaded to archive.org. That's got a lot of things up there. But it's a first I hadn't heard of before, and I'm dubious that it's a first, but I'm fascinated anyway. So it's a game called Caper in the Castro, which a lot of people are claiming is the first LGBTQ computer game. So it was released in 1987. Released in 1989. And it was a HyperCard-based game, so a HyperCard stack, and a person named C.M. Ralph, was the programmer behind it. And that game is now available on archive.org, so you can play it. We're going to have a couple of links. So there's also a company called, it's on archive.org, and there's a write-up about it on Motherboard. So it made a bit of a splash maybe about a month ago or so when it was found and uploaded. It's a game that is like a detective game. You play – it's pretty funny. You play a detective named Tracker McDyke, who is a lesbian – I love the name. And you're up against somebody called like – Dim Straight Man or something. It's like the bad guy. It's so amazing. So the game was like a bit of an underground hit, I guess, and wasn't something that I guess the CM Ralph could find somebody to be a big publisher for. So he or she just straightenified the game, took out all the LGBTQ stuff, and re-released it as a game called Murder on Main Street. So that's essentially the same game, just straightened up, and that found a publisher and was released. That is also available online to play, but the original one has now been found and uploaded. So one, I think this is an important thing. If it is the first, essentially, there were gay characters and gay elements in games, but this is the first, like, just by and for a non-straight audience and a very non-straight friendly game. So that's super cool and a really important element. So I'm glad it's been found and uploaded. But I can't believe...
Yeah.
Not till like 1989 there was – now, I don't know. I wasn't in the target market, so I don't know if there was something earlier. But I suspect there must have been. I mean, a marginalized community, but holy cow, did they not have a game at all until 1989? That seems crazily late to me. Yeah. So I'm hoping somebody knows, like somebody will hear this and go, oh no, this game in early 80s or 70s or 60s? Like, shouldn't there have been one in the 70s? At least this is crazy. It's so late.
Yeah.
Hopefully somebody out there hears this and also thinks, well, no, there was something earlier. Then put that info out there. Find it. Stick it on archive.org and we can talk about it because I think it's an important thing and it would have been lost to history otherwise. So this now exists. I'm dubious that I hope it's not the first one. That's crazy late. But it's neat that it exists now and I had never heard of it before.
Yeah, no, I hadn't either. I agree that just it can't be the first, but I mean the problem with even trying to talk about that is just that, like, how do you define what this is, what the category parameters right. are, you know, like to say that this is the first anything. It's
exactly because I mean there's gay elements or non-straight elements at least in a couple of earlier Infocom games that we haven't talked about on Eaten by a Grew yet, but I know in the something of the Planet of Somethings. If a guy talks about Infocom games, you think I would know more about them. And Moon Mist. Both of those have, like, homosexual elements in them, but I don't think they'd be considered a gay and lesbian based game.
Right.
Whereas this is full on. This is referred to as a game, G-A-Y-M-E. So also just Tracker McDyke. What a great name. Yeah. I just love that the detective is Tracker McDyke. So anyway, maybe the first. If so, I think that's sad. It shouldn't have been the first. I bet you this will be earlier. And if so, then that should be found, because I think it's an important thing.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. I guess I am. Oh, yeah. So I have the next thing here. Because I am just terrible at eliminating links, I've called this my project corner, where I have put two different projects. So I will talk about both of them. The first of them is this project called the Apple II Plus Mini, and it's I don't know a whole lot about this. So Call Apple posted a little like sort of announcement about it that linked to a YouTube video, and the the description of the YouTube video, there's actually a link to a Facebook page that has a little bit more information on it. So as long as you're on Facebook, you can see this. In the video, it's a little kind of like homebrew Apple II Plus emulator, or it's not exactly an emulator. It's an Apple II Plus, you know, built on a modern PCB. So it's got little key switches for the keyboard, like little tiny ones. What do you call them? Momentary switches or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a little, sort of modern LCD thing, but it's actually got a real 6502. And the thing that I think is kind of coolest about it is it has like a real game port, a real cassette in out, a real Apple II peripheral slot that you can plug an actual Apple II card into.
It's all in something the size of like a Game Boy.
Yeah.
It's all this tiny little thing.
But so, I mean, like in the video, you have this little, Apple II thing, with like a disk drive plugged into it, and actually booting a real disk, which is cool. And then, I think it's, using a floppy emu as the, flash card thing. But it's really, it's quite astonishing. I'd be quite interested to hear more about this. Take a look at the video at least. My impression is, so there's pretty much no narration. There's a little bit of subtitling of what's happening, but you can sort of see it runs the game Black Magic, and I guess you can play it. It'd be fun to build this when it's spec'd out, but I don't think it's available. I mean, like, I don't think you can see exactly what the design is. I might be wrong. I might be wrong actually. There's a photo of the PCB. How can it be so simple?
Yeah, that's what I keep thinking too. How is it so simple?
Uh-huh. I think I see something that says Atmel. I think that's how it can be so simple.
Okay.
So it's got a modern microprocessor helping with everything except the 6502 interpretation.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But I totally want one of these. Just the idea that you can plug a peripheral card in is...
Well, I like that it's a little handheld thing, essentially, that size, but you can plug a full-size peripheral card in it and hook it up to a full-size 5 1/4-inch floppy.
Right.
Which is, yeah, which is like...
Getting 10 rid of
times
the
size.
It's, yeah, totally. So it's kind of ridiculous and adorable. I like it.
Yeah. And then, so the other thing in the project corner is the ZX Spectrum Next laptop, which is, it's basically... I thought this was actually just an individual person's project, but there is some. Apparently, there was a Kickstarter, so I guess I didn't read this very carefully before I started talking about it. But it's thought of as the laptop that Sinclair never made, right? That it's internally, it's basically a ZX Spectrum recreated on an FPGA. But in a laptop form factor, so there are some images of a constructed unit, and it looks quite pretty. I would be totally into having one of these because there's no issues about power conversion or video conversion because it's got an LCD in it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I mean, that's for those of us outside of Europe, essentially, outside of the world of PAL. That's the big advantage.
Yeah.
That it's self-contained and would run. And what I like about it is the laptop design is, you know, very chunky on the bottom and has a 4x3 screen in the middle of a wider area. It's like a period-looking laptop. So it looks like a laptop, but it looks like a laptop circa 1994, right? So I like that. I like that it's got a vintage aesthetic to it, where it's big and chunky and has a ton of ports and a relatively small screen in the lid, and I dig it.
But it has, you know, the nice color palette and all that of the Spectrum.
Oh, that color palette! Shocking color palette.
It's lovely. Yeah,
I love the fact that on the back of it or on the side of the. Probably my favorite design element is there's
the colors.
I think four colored lights on the lid.
Yeah.
The blue and green. And that is a great design element. That is nicely chosen. That's beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It really does sort of stand out. It's just like, are they actually lit? I guess maybe they are.
It looks like they lit up, and it's gorgeous. I mean, that is a sweet element.
Yeah, definitely take a look at the photos here. Actually, and one thing I forgot to mention too about the the Mini 2 Plus Mini thing is that the one of the things that the creator has done is also written something called EDD Write, which actually seems to be allowing the I really want to kind of explore this because it seems to be allowing the writing out to a disk of an EDD file, which is a pretty low level dump of the data on a disk, and this is there's a certain technical impossibility to this. So I'm kind of curious to see what it is that they've actually done, because the thing
technically that, impossible, the best impossible,
right? The best kind of impossible, yes. But I don't really know exactly what's happening here, but it at least takes as input an EDD file and creates a disk. The technical impossibility has to do with the fact that an EDD file has it's got like about 2.5 samples of each track, and each track is they're so close together that the disk drive itself can't write a track without overwriting the tracks next to it. So it is technically impossible, but I'm kind of wondering what the what was done here, because the idea was supposed to be that you could get these EDD files from this big pile that's on archive.org and create things. So even if you don't want the little emulator, it might be interesting to see what this thing is doing. I think that has brought us to the end. And so it's time for a word from our sponsor.
Grandpa, you want to play Pac-Man?
Pac-Man? Poor Steve.
I'll show you, Grandpa.
Pac-Man is a video game cartridge you have to buy separately to play on the Atari video computer system. Your parents hook it up to the TV.
Those are supposed to be the ghosts after Pac-Man. Watch out, Grandpa! Stick with me. You'll get the hang of it.
This is the Atari video computer system. Pac-Man and other video game cartridges are each sold separately.
And we're back. All right, so it falls to me to pick the host gift idea. And the gift idea I have picked for you is it's an iPhone case. This particular one I thought was pretty cool. It is... The image on the back is of an Altair 8800. So it, you know, has the nice sort of silver nameplate at the bottom, and it has little, obviously just pictures of little LEDs and switches and things like that. But it looks very pleasing, and it's a nice sort of technological contrast between the, you know, supercomputer that is behind this case. So the one we're particularly linking to here is for the iPhone SE 5 and 5S, because that's what I have.
Ah, excellent. But I think it's available for a bunch of different ones. Yeah. But yeah.
Right. If you want to buy the real thing, since I can't stop finding eBay links, I will quickly point out an eBay link to the just recently posted actual Mits.
Oh, they go for so much money, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the starting bid on this particular one is $9,995.
Oh, my gosh. $10,000.
Just about $10,000.
Whew.
But this,
plus they're heavy, so shipping would always be quite a bit.
And... Yeah, it's listed as $400 shipping.
Is that all?
Yeah, but this particular one is really it's nice. I think it's still optimistic, but it's full of cards, and it has a floppy drive underneath it, and that looks pretty cool. It's in great shape. You know, I think this is basically, if you are essentially in a situation where money is pretty much no object and you want a really nice one, this is it.
That's a pretty small target audience.
Yeah. I think if you're a museum.
Basically, it's WAS or museums. Yeah. Did you hear that New Zealand is going to be putting a line where people from outside New Zealand or foreigners are not allowed to buy property? Didn't WAS just move to New Zealand? And is it a coincidence they're now saying, we're going to bring in a law right across this whole country? No more of that.
Yeah, I don't know. Was it New Zealand or was it Australia?
New Zealand.
Was it? Okay.
Or where did he move? Oh, who knows? Yeah. It was. He moves where he wants. Like, well, the wind.
Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, I mean, it seems like it almost doesn't matter because he's, you know, where there's a place, you know, where his mail gets sent, but he's always flying around everywhere.
Yes.
So, anyway, so that's the two gifts ideas, I guess. You can either get someone an iPhone case or you can get them a...
Buy them an Altair.
Okay, anyway, so I guess I've already sort of launched into the eBay auctions, but I will cede the floor for a little bit to Carrington.
I actually have an eBay auction this time. I think last time I was like, stop buying things. Won't fill the void. But something cropped up I'm not going to buy, but it's really interesting because I didn't know it existed. I am a fan of the board game / computer game Star Saga 1. Star Sega 1? Saga. I say Saga. Star Saga 1. Mm-hmm. And it was a big old box, huge and heavy, and it's a board game that also uses a computer, and like 1 to 6 people can play it. And we started a game at Kansas Fest with the idea of playing over multiple years, but it kind of collapsed because it's very difficult and very huge. And I'd heard that there was a second game, a Star Saga 2, but that it didn't come out for the Apple II, which was the platform in which we were playing it. Well, it turns out, I guess it did come out for the Apple II. Somebody must have known this because there's one of them on eBay and it doesn't come up that much. So it's Star Saga 2, the Clathrin Menace for the Apple II GS. So who knew? You do not require Star Saga 1 to play it. It is self-contained. All 40 pounds of box that it is or so. So it's got the massive fold-out map and the 6 huge books, one for each character, plus the huge collection of reading material. You read, like, it's basically a very reading heavy game, but they're really cool. And it turns out it existed for the Apple II series, or at least the Apple II GS. And the Apple II GS version is currently on eBay for $275. Buy it now. Kind of a beat up box. But you don't see it very often. I ain't going to buy it. And I hope that whoever does buy it scans the heck out of it if scans are not already in existence.
Yeah, I think this is the only one I've ever seen. I've seen this one listed a couple times, but I mean, it's pretty rare, but it's a comical amount of reading material. I mean, it's like there's an overview photo that has, you know, books. I guess a book goes up to book N, books A through N, and then there's like another set of what you said, I guess 6 books for the characters and all
this
stuff.
Get like a character booklet you read, and then there's the other 14 or something books you have to read during the game and reading on screen. And reading. It was a fun game. Like, the best we played, I really liked it. I would actually like to take another run at it, but it's a lot of reading.
Yeah. And then there's like this one like little 3.5-inch disc sitting in the middle. That's the computer part. But I think maybe Star Saga 1 was also 2GS only, though. Or at least I have one of those, and that's 2GS.
The one we played, I think, was... I'm pretty sure the one we played was on 5.25-inch.
Okay.
I think we played it on a 2E at Kansas Fest. So maybe that was what I was confused about, that the regular 8-bit version didn't exist and the 2GS one did for Star Saga 2. I just thought it only existed for, like, modern computers or PC only or didn't exist at all. I don't know. I never seen Star Saga 2 before, so I was excited to see it. So that is my choice.
Cool.
Yeah, that's cool. It's cool to see.
Just the amount of books and stuff, all that material, makes you think about... Have you guys seen this thing about this notoriously long board game? It's a war game called The Campaign for North Africa. They say it takes 1,500 hours to complete this game.
Oh, my goodness.
Somebody made in the 80s, a guy named Richard Berg. Apparently, he's designed hundreds of war games, and this is like, he knew this was just like obscenely long, but made it anyway, and the company that he worked for, I guess, went and produced it and sold it. And, can't imagine playing it, but kind of. You see it spread.
I see
photos of it spread out, and like if you imagine a Monopoly board, the board for this game looks like it's about 8 or 10 times the size of that.
Oh, I think even more than that. This is massive. Holy moly. The box, which is crazy thick, also has the tagline, a super detailed, intensive simulation specially designed for maximum realism.
Yeah.
Wow.
Maximum time.
That looks like a game that goes on for a while. Yeah. You're not single when you begin playing. You will be by the end of this thing. Actually, well, who am I kidding? You'll be single when you begin playing.
Yeah. Come on.
The one board game to rule them all.
Yeah, looking at the one fold-out map, it just goes and goes and goes and goes. It's got to unfold to like 7 feet long. That's hilarious. Okay, cool.
So hopefully Star Saga 2 is more accessible than that.
Yeah. Well, and you'll have practice from Star Saga 1, because I think it's got about as much reading material as this one.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all paper.
Learned nothing from the first one. Cool.
Very cool. Okay, so I couldn't stop because I can never stop. But I'm going to provide a somewhat abridged version. You can imagine that there were more. Okay, so the first thing I found was it's a Farallon Mac recorder sound system. So the title of the eBay auction is actually kind of messed up. So, in fact, it's possible people might miss this. What's kind of cool about this is that it's the device, a sound edit disc, and comes with the manual and a product catalog, and it looks like it's actually in pretty good shape. I think of this as being, like, I'm not actually sure this is something you'd want to use, but it feels to me at least like this was influential. You know, like, sound edit for sure was a huge thing in that era, that sort of like early 90s Mac era of it's just like this was the thing you used to edit any kind of sound file, and the Mac recorder device was actually a way that you could digitize, you know, outside samples. So it's kind of neat to see this in relatively good shape. But is this familiar to either of you?
No, not at all.
It is not. Sound edit, definitely. I remember even seeing the disc for sound edit. But I don't know why I don't know this Mac recorder system.
It was probably, you know, somewhat expensive, but you know, not super expensive. But I think it was, there may have been a sort of a small audience for it. But if, you know, anytime you wanted to like sample something from a TV show or a movie or something like that, or some kind of song or whatever, this was the kind of thing you needed to get, because they're, you know, computers didn't have any other built-in sound input, or at least not the Mac. So. At any rate, I thought it was kind of neat to see.
And you're right, though, but you're right to point out that it's the kind of thing that makes things slip unpurchased on eBay, because like this is the Mac recorder, all one word, and this is listed as Farallon Mac Reader Sound System.
Right.
Mac and Reader. So if you're looking for Mac recorder, you wouldn't even find this thing. Like those words don't even appear in this auction. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of stuff where only somebody like Paul, who probably just looks at every single vintage auction item every week, is not going to miss. But for your average purchaser like me, if I was looking for one of these things, this would come and go and I wouldn't even notice. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I'm not looking for such things.
Yeah.
Paul wants to buy two of them.
Right. It's actually not too bad either. I mean, like, so right now it's sort of discounted, but it's a $35 buy it now. So, I mean, it's, you know, whatever that is, 7 coffees. So, yeah.
That's a dangerous way to think of things, Paul.
Right, yeah. But anyway, okay, so let's see. I will move on to the next thing I thought was kind of interesting was the, there's an Echo PC Plus speech synthesizer card, which is it's a speech synthesizer card that goes in the, you know, IBM PC line. The Echo card was a super popular one on the Apple too. I can't remember if I knew this or not, but if I knew that the Echo PC Plus existed, I had forgotten. I think it's kind of interesting to see it. So presumably it's basically the same thing as the Echo 2 on the Apple 2. Anyway, if you're looking for such things. Did you ever play any games that talked to you?
No, I never even had a Mockingboard.
Huh. I don't know if, you know, honestly, I don't know if I have either had a Mockingboard. I think I have a clone, but yeah, I mean, so I remember playing with it in elementary school because we had an Echo Card on the Apple II. And it was kind of, you know, it's fun for 35 minutes. See if you can get
it. So that's
to swear.
Like a dollar a minute.
Right.
Like, exactly. So if you think about it, this thing is a $30 auction. So that's on a per minute value basis.
Yeah.
It's a steal.
That's right. So, right. It's a starting bid of $30. And yeah, it's pretty reasonable if you were looking for such a thing. Again, that's there it is. Okay. So the next thing I wanted to point out was Ian sent this in actually to me to point it out. It's a 3.5-inch semi-automatic floppy disk diskette labeler. So it's a little machine that will apply labels to floppy disks. Such a thing exists, I think, is the main takeaway.
Who knew? That's amazing. Look at this. It's like a little tiny thing sitting on your desktop and it would label your disks. But I guess if you were a manufacturer or whatever, mm-hmm. and you're pumping out disks, this would be useful. I didn't even know this kind of thing existed.
Yeah, I that's what I'm assuming, that's must have been what this was for. Like, you know, you didn't just get one of these on your normal desk.
But if you were a game publisher or whatever, yeah, right. Then this is what you would use it for. So, cool.
Yeah. So, it's not cheap. There's a $500 buy it now. There is a make offer. But if you, you know, have some nostalgia for this for some reason, there it is.
It doesn't work. That's the problem. It's currently really? Non-functional. Well, it seems to stall. They say you put a disc in and it jams or something. So probably fixable, I guess. But if it actually worked, it would be more tempting considering it's $500.
Yeah, true. They say this is the only one on eBay or anywhere.
Well,
don't let it get away. So sometimes the little sales pitches and the descriptions are kind of goofy. But
do they work on you, though? Do you want it?
Well, I noticed them. Like, I usually I'm sort of skeptical when I see that, because I mean, like, what that tends to suggest to me is that this is somebody who doesn't really know what they're doing. They just like searched eBay, right, and didn't see it.
Right.
On this one, it might be true, but I mean, like, on a lot of these, it's sort of like, yeah, it's the only one on eBay, but that's just because, you know, there was a big rush on them a month and a half ago.
I don't think there were a big rush on these.
These, no, probably not. Okay, so the next one is maybe kind of in the same category. The kind of thing you're not going to buy. It's a $7,500 buy it now.
You don't know me. You don't know my life. Maybe I want it. What is it?
It is. It's an IBM 3890 operator panel for
okay, I'm out.
A sorter
you're right.
Unit or something.
Why would somebody spend $7,500 on that?
I don't know, but it looks pretty cool. So that was me. I kind of wanted to just sort of point it out to people. This is actually, I think this might be another one that says, like, doesn't this one have a sales pitch on it as well?
Be the only one to own one of these. You will not see another.
Yeah. Yes, right. That's what I remembered. But it looks, I don't know, there's something that's really quite pleasing about this. It's got lots and lots of little red LEDs and switches down the left side and these little knobs that have a clear backing disc with the numbers right. on them and stuff. And it looks so, it looks 60s-ish somehow. Mm.
This looks like peak gatekeeper. Like when computers like, no, don't touch it.
Yeah.
It's complicated. I can do it. This is the peak of that era.
Yeah. Mm. Designed specifically for like the job security of the technicians.
Yeah. Tons of little acronyms and dials and buttons and yeah.
Cool. I find that one of the blue buttons in the front panel is labeled Matrix Enter.
Yes.
This is how you enter the Matrix, guys.
Pretty scary.
So it begins.
Soft stop. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this it's definitely just take a look at it. But the thing is, so it's it looks very impressive from the front. It's actually surprisingly thin. If you sort of look through the pictures, you can see that it's not actually a very thick thing. And it actually, if you happen to have a sorter that you would want to replace the panel from, it's been like the attachment mounts have been sawed off. So it really is kind of a display unit. But anyway, whatever. I thought it was pleasing looking and thought I would point it out to everybody. Okay, I will skip the thing that has already been sold, but there was a relatively beat up Next Cube case that was selling empty for $100 and somebody bought it. Which
was
makes
it you?
Sense. It was not me, but okay. But I mean, I would I might have bought it if it weren't so beat up. because...
I thought you were saying you might have bought it. Like, you buy so many things now, you don't even remember. I might have bought this. Yeah. It's hard to tell.
Well, I considered it, and because the thing is about the cube, it's the way it looks, right? I mean, like, I could put a Raspberry Pi inside of it and emulate the next, but unfortunately, this particular cube was very, very beat up. I mean, it was repainted or something, I suppose, but so I guess I'll leave the link in there so you can see what I'm talking about. But anyway, okay, so two sort of impressive things to mention, and then I'll stop. So one is there is a Spartan that is listed. It is a Apple II emulator for the Commodore 64. We must have talked about this before. They come up.
We have, but you don't see them much.
No. Yeah. And actually, I was pretty pleased with myself because, you know, as I'm looking through the listings, just like, you know, scroll, I saw it and thought, oh, Spartan, even before I even read the description. Like, yeah, it's recognizably ugly.
Right. That is true. Yes. Oh, and for people who don't know, it's the Apple II attachment thingy for Commodore 64.
Yeah. It is essentially an Apple II in a box that you stick in the back of a Commodore 64 so that the Commodore 64 can serve as your keyboard.
Right.
That's essentially what it is.
Yes. It is really remarkably useless. But it is super rare. And if you, for some reason, go, I'll use an Apple II, but dear Lord, I don't want to touch one. I can only touch my Commodore 64 keyboard.
Right.
Then this is a way to do that and not like lower yourself to a different cast. But other than that, I don't see a lot of purpose in it.
Yeah, it's weird. But they also had, I mean, like another thing that's they're kind of noted for are their terrible, terrible ads, which I don't think there's a picture of this in the auction, but it was basically the spokes entity for this was this clown, really creepy looking thing. It's probably possible to find do a Google search and find a Spartan ad with a clown, it really seemed like a very poor idea to use this marketing campaign.
Yeah, and not fun clown. You got to think like it's this weird. It's like the mime clown, if I remember. It's like the clown that'd be like all in black with the white face on and the white gloves and just creepy mime clown. Yeah, it's not a good idea.
No. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Okay. So I searched for Spartan C64 mime clown ad, and managed to find it. But yeah, no, it's terrible. So do that search. These are super rare. People do want them. And as a result, the starting bid is $1,500. You can buy it now for $2,500. I don't know what's going to happen. The person who's selling it knows.
There's a chance it'll sell for that.
Yeah.
These sell for crazy money.
Oh, you know, actually, this is the same. This is the same seller that had like the pets and stuff before. I think this person has a very nice collection that is being dismantled. It appears, but it's coming out of Nova Scotia, so.
Ooh,
it's
okay.
On your side of the border.
Yay.
Okay, and then the last one I was going to mention was a HP 85. So it's one of these like calculator computer things, pretty large thing. And I think they're huge, but I think they're cool. And it's got, it looks like it has a 16K memory module with it. It's kind of dirty, but I think it's, you know, salvageable. It's notable because it's got a starting bid of $100, which is cheap. And it's got a shipping cost that is actually got to be false. I mean, like they're going to lose money on the shipping. It's shipping to me is listed as $14, basically.
Nope. No, they're big and heavy.
Yeah.
Well, I say big, but it's – whenever I look at one of these, I have a weird relationship with the 85.
Mm-hmm.
Because you got to not think of it as – like a computer with a ridiculously tiny screen. Like the screen on them is a couple of inches square. It's 5 inches, 4 inches square, something really small.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to think of it as a very large calculator because it's really a calculator. It has that whole it's got that little printer in it. Like the screen's on the one side and the other side actually has one of those little tiny printers. So it's like an adding machine,
mm-hmm.
but a computerized adding machine. So if you want to have like a unbelievably cool retro calculator on your desk. That's what this is. So it's more like an adding machine replacement. They're bonkers neat. I love them. I love the keyboard on them.
Mm-hmm.
They're really cool. So while I don't like computers from that era that are the the suitcase ones with the tiny little screens, because I think they're kind of useless as a computer. These are amazingly cool as a calculator.
Right. Yeah. No, I wouldn't mind having one of these. And this is pretty cheap, I think. I mean, like, I would be very surprised if it didn't sell. If it's less than three digits to the left of the decimal point, I think that's a pretty good deal for these. So.
Right. There are a couple others on eBay right now that have buy it now prices of respectively $1,000 and $1,300. So
Yeah,
that's kind of more what they often list for.
Right. Okay. So I think I will leave it at that. While I was rambling on and on and on about eBay auctions, I had found, Jack found one.
I did.
Jack, what did you find?
I found one. I found a vintage 1978 HP 5036A microprocessor lab board. This is one of these microprocessor trainers. It's not the complete thing. So the complete thing has a keypad and display elements that this is missing for some reason. But what I like about this compared to some of the ones that we talked about before is that this one, it looks really cool. The motherboard has these sort of paths, like it has the data bus and the address bus and things painted on top of the circuit board with like arrows pointing out the different chips and the different things, and it's quite cool. Mm-hmm. I like the way that it's sort of like, I like the way it looks. I like the kind of labeling of all of the things.
Mm-hmm. I like the arrows in particular. You can see the path go from the address bus and it kind of goes down into the ROM and into the data bus, but it goes down the RAM and then it's two ways from the RAM to the data bus and stuff. And just that kind of, that's neat. Yep.
Yeah. It's like the block diagram on the board as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite pretty. But like I said, it's missing components. It doesn't have a CPU. It doesn't have the keypads. It doesn't have the displays. So like you would need a lot of other pieces to get this actually working. And even at that, it costs $150 just for what it is right now. That's the buy it now price. So I don't know if it's worth it in terms of wanting to have a thing to use, because there's a lot of parts you still need, but I could imagine just buying this and displaying it, because it's actually a very nice looking thing in a sense. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't tell for sure if I would have seen one had it come up before, but I don't feel like I've seen one before.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I've seen evidence of some past sales of these on eBay, but all I've seen is other incomplete ones. There are pictures on computerhistory.org.uk of the complete one that's in like a suitcase where you can see all of the keypad and stuff like that.
I see.
But I haven't found any of those for sale. Anyway, that's what I got.
It's pretty big.
Yeah, it's like actually 11 inches square.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big thing.
Because I didn't think it was so big until I like looked at one of the chips and thought and realized that I just sort of realized that I know how big that chip is.
Right. Yeah, the last picture in the series actually has a ruler at the bottom. You can see it's 11 inches across.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty substantial.
Okay, so I guess we've made it through all of our eBay auctions, and we can now sort of talk about our closing thoughts. Let's see. Okay, Carrington, you have something? Is this marathon related?
I just played through Marathon. Yeah, I just played through Marathon again recently. I loved it back in the day, and I had downloaded Aleph 1, which is the sort of the modern remake of it. Oops, in fact, hovering my mouse over it, I've just accidentally launched it. So we'll just quit that again. Marathon. Yeah. And I'm a big fan. It runs perfectly on a modern Mac. So if you want to run, and also on Windows and Linux, I think. Mm-hmm. But if you have a modern computer and you want to revisit Marathon, this is the easiest way to do it, because it's the actual maps, the actual game, just done modern. Super simple. Has multiplayer play as well, although I think PSP will play the third one in the trilogy, Marathon Infinity, and also has no access to all the other scenarios. Like there's homebrew ones and like a homebrew fourth game and whatever. I've never played any of those, but I loved Marathon back in the day and did lots of LAN parties, not in lands down under, but lands up here. And just have a real soft spot for it. Like I loved Marathon. It was my first big LAN type game I got super into, and I loved playing. I loved the solo game, and I just sort of stumble across Aleph 1 again. It's, oh, right, this game. I love this game. So downloaded it all, ran perfectly, ran easily, and I've just played through the entirety of the first Marathon game, and I suspect I will now work my way through the rest of the trilogy, because it's just so much fun.
Yeah, I remember liking that quite a bit. I played the first one probably more than the other ones. The weird thing is, it's not quite Doom. It feels a little bit different.
Totally does.
I kind of.
You can look up and down.
Yeah. Right? Well, yeah, that's true. But I liked how it looked. I didn't like as much how it felt. I think the one in this genre that I liked the most was Dark Forces. That was Star Wars.
I like Dark
game.
Forces a lot as well. But I played a lot of Marathon as a land game, that and like Duke Nukem and stuff, early Mac land gaming. And I really love that stuff. So it's fun to revisit it. So anyway, I played Marathon. It was great.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. I periodically install Aleph 1. And, I install it more often than I play it. But I do have. And somewhere I actually have like the box, I think, for the Marathon games. I bought them all.
Trilogy. Yeah. There was like a one. I bought them all originally, and then I think they came out with a trilogy box that had the three games in it near the end of its life, before Bungie went over to the Halo side.
Right, right.
It's cool.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I know that I've downloaded this once, and I think also launched it exactly once, and then just got. I think my kids were little, and I just didn't have time to play anything. So, I remember I'd heard about it. And I had not been a Mac user back in the day, and so I bought it, or I didn't buy it. I downloaded this and tried it out, and it's like, oh, that looks cool. I'll have to get back.
See, I don't know if it's the kind of game I would recommend. Like, I really liked it, and so I have nostalgia for it because I played it back in the day.
Right.
So I was replaying Marathon, and I love it. I love the story. It's got a really neat story behind the scenes where it's like computers kind of going insane that you're working with, and really, really fun game from a plot standpoint. So you're playing through a first-person shooter, but it's got an interesting plot that as you go. And I really like that. But I don't know if I had never played it back in the day, if I would really dig playing it now. So I don't know if I'd give a broad recommendation. But if you did play Marathon back in the 90s or whatever, you should just know that there is a version that you can play on all modern computers that just download and play it. Works great. Don't have to download anything else. It's just totally free. Just one installer, and it runs perfect, and it's great.
Now that you've reminded me, we'll have to do this. I forget if I talked about this before. I probably did, because I think we talked about Bungie before. But on marathon.bungie.org, there's a page that says Boston Macworld Expo August 94 reports, and that page leads off with a message from me to CompSys Mac Games saying, "Okay, Macworld's here. Like, what happened? Is it out?" It's really quite funny, because this was apparently when they were supposed to release it, and I think it was they had demos for it. But so
good. I had joked on Twitter, I think, that I was like, "Hey, I'm going to play Bungie again. I really like it. Maybe I should lug down some vintage hardware, or set up a LAN tournament at Kansas Fest." And Quinn rightly pointed out that, yeah, doing Mac gaming will go over really well at an Apple II conference,
right,
where people kind of still are a little touchy about that subject. Right. I'm like, oh, yeah, it's probably true.
There's an audience for that probably still.
Yeah, but whatever. It's also this other place where we play over the net, but I thought that was pretty funny. I'm like, oh, right, yes. She's a little more level-headed about these things than I am. Not really one for looking ahead.
Right.
Not me.
All right, Jack, you have written a cryptic note.
Oh, yeah, I finally got my my Atari 7800 working, which I bought a few months ago, and found that the description in Italian, which I didn't read, said that the power supply was not complete. Like, the power, the cable on the power supply had been lopped off, and the cable was gone. And on the device itself, it has a really weird non-standard power socket, which the plug for which is just an opinion. So I opened it up and replaced it with a barrel socket, much thanks to Vic from 10 Pence Arcade, who pointed me in the right direction, telling me which side is negative, which side is positive, so I didn't blow my thing up. And it works great. That's all.
Cool.
I've never had a 7800. The thing that turned me off was the look of, well, I didn't like that Atari design aesthetic that much, but it was more the look of the joysticks, those long kind of skinny ones you hold and with the buttons on either side, didn't appeal to me. So that kind of turned me off the system, although the games appealed. But googling it now, it looks like there are other controllers available.
Yeah, so
more and a gamepad style that would appeal.
So my understanding is the ones that were released here in Europe have these gamepads instead. So this came with a couple of gamepads. So it's more like a traditional, 80s style gamepad obviously taking cues from the popularity of the NES at the time. But my feeling is that those are, they're super mushy. They just like don't feel good, either the D-pad or the buttons. Mm. But what I have is I have this super joystick that I bought from Ed Ladin a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, that works for 7800. And it's an awesome arcade joystick, you know, with clicky bits and all this. So it's, that's great for that. And also if you have a Sega Genesis controller, you can have a little adapter that will let the two buttons on that work on this. Because a lot of 7800 games require two separate buttons, which traditional old Atari joysticks don't have. Or they might have two buttons, but they're the same button, like electronically. Mm. So,
hey, because there's some Atari 7800 games that looked really good. Like, I have wanted to pick one of these up or play it, because some of them look like just arcade quality. They look fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, compared to, I mean, I'm used to both the 8-bit computers and the old 2600. And of the little that I've played so far, the few games that I have, I mean, it just blows everything away in terms of the older machines. The only sort of drawback is mm-hmm. that for some reason, the built-in audio is the exact same hardware as the 2600 audio, which is weird because the 8-bit computers had the Pokechip, which was so much better, and they decided to not use that in the 7800, except some of the cartridges have their own Pokechip on the cartridge.
That was much more sensible.
Yeah. They decided to save, like, you know, save the $2 on the actual hardware of the machine to put that expense on the cartridge production instead. And apparently it's a thing where those games that have that, I think it's Ball Blazer and one or two others that have a Pokey on board. And there's a risk that if you buy those cartridges off of eBay, you'll find you bought one that has had its Pokey chip removed.
Right.
Oh,
right.
Huh.
Because people are harvesting Pokey chips for other purposes.
Well, yeah, I was thinking that too, actually, that I mean, maybe it's better to pull open a Ball Blazer cartridge than destroy an actual Atari 8-bit computer.
Right.
True. Yeah. Pretty rough.
Agree to disagree.
Right. I think that the numbering is just ridiculous on these game consoles. The 7800 is like, now we're at 3x2600.
Right. Yeah.
I guess we could predict maybe what the next one would be.
Well, the thing what I've read lately that
10400.
What I've read lately that I didn't really realize at the time was that the first system was only called the VCS up until the 5200, which is the same technically as the 8-bit computers, was released, and that's when they backtracked and renamed the VCS 2600.
Huh.
So why did they call the 5200 the 5200?
Because it was.
Why didn't they call it the 5000?
I don't know.
And call the first one the 2500? What is wrong with you, Atari?
I don't know what they were doing. Too much beer.
I'm sure there was a reason. I guess just none of us know what it is. Somebody will write it and tell us what the reason is. Well, that just seems really strange.
Yeah, there's probably a reason. I don't know.
2600 is the number of hertz that the blue box emanates to knock out the operator from the trunk line.
It's true.
So I was assumed it was based, like, the 2600 was based around that, but I thought it was called the VCS, but also the 2600 at the same time. I didn't know that it was like a back naming.
Yeah, what I read lately is that they actually switched at the time of the release of the 5200. But
okay, did it because of that Jonathan Coulton song. Maybe that came out way earlier than I thought.
But the Christmas one or whatever, yeah.
Yeah,
the Christmas one, the 2600. Such a good song.
Probably the time period that he was singing about when he was wanted at 2600, it probably was not even called that yet. It was probably still called the VCS.
Oh, let's write him a bunch of nerdy notes about that.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, actually,
Jonathan, I'm
actually,
so mad at you now.
Yeah.
VCS! Drag out that asshole.
But now, wait a second. Okay. So, the label really doesn't say 2600 on it?
No. Well, I think on later ones it does. Definitely on the ones that came out in the 80s, like the 2600, the 2600 Junior, the ones that stylistically look like the 7800, those say 2600. But like the one that it says video computer system.
Yeah, video computer system. Like the one I had as a kid just said video computer system above the cartridge slot. I don't remember it having a 2600 on it now that you say that.
Yeah.
At the time, I just called it the Atari.
Yeah.
Like when it was the thing out, it was just the Atari. No one, I didn't even call it VCS. No. I had an Atari.
Yeah, it was the Atari.
You have an Atari or you have an Intellivision, whatever.
However, it appears. See, this is what I thought, that the label does say model number CX 2600 though. on the bottom.
Okay, so maybe that was like the model version? Number, but it was not. It was just like it was like an SKU. It was just like the product ID number, but it's not, you know, using the marketing.
It says Wikipedia, which is never wrong, says following the release of the Atari 5200 in November 1982, the VCS was renamed to the Atari 2600 after the unit's part number CX2600.
There you go.
Okay. And mystery solved. Who knows why it's called CX2600, but that might still be Blue Box related.
There we go.
Cool.
People who know this stuff are screaming at their podcast player right now. All the Atari people are like, you are so useless. You Apple people know nothing. Like, it's so obvious that everybody knows this. And, well, I don't. Someone will tell us. Frankly, I'd rather have the Sears one nowadays than the Atari one. If I was to go and pick one up, I'd rather have the Sears one. I think the Telegames.
Sears Telegames.
Same thing, but if I'm going to do it, I'm going to go Sears.
Just be distinctive.
Right.
Yeah, I'll show those Atari people. Even if I play your games, I'm going to play it on the Sears thing.
Is Sears still around?
Do you have an Atari at home? No, I have a Sears.
I think Sears closed in Canada. I think in the States as well.
Yeah.
You guys also just lost Toys R Us, though it still exists in Canada.
Ah, okay. Well, a reason to visit.
What is Toys R Us closed?
We'll see how long it lasts with buying. Yeah.
That's interesting.
I think it did, I think I remember seeing this. You know, on the periphery of my vision and the headlines that are going by in amongst all the other crap. let's see. Oh, yeah. Speaking of blue boxes. Yeah. Just yesterday, I noticed, I think Jason Scott posted about this on the Apple II Enthusiasts Facebook group. But Jason made this BBS documentary, a big thing. It's a wonderful documentary. And in it, he interviewed a whole bunch of people about a whole bunch of things. And it's divided up into, I forget, like eight or nine episodes or something like that. And what Jason has been doing recently is uploading the source video for those interviews. Because, of course, you know, it's many, many people were interviewed. Many, many hours were involved. And it's got, it got sort of chopped up so that the highlights were in the interview. And you know, more of the people talking and less of Jason talking behind the camera to them and that sort of thing. So what he's been doing is going through his original source stuff and uploading them. And the one that sort of caught my attention was the MPG, Midwest Pirates Guild interview, which actually also had, let's see, where is it? Greg Schaefer was there. I think Greg Schaefer, who is the author of an Apple II BBS system called GBBS that was used fairly widely. I'm not sure if he actually appeared in the documentary itself, but he was in the room at the time. So the source video has discussions with these people from the Midwest Pirates Guild who were they? Sinbad and
wait, the comedian?
No.
That would have been awesome.
I'm not sure. I think he was credited. I think he was credited in the documentary as Sinbad Sailor, but I think he actually sort of referred to himself as Sinbad and Minnie Epler, who were from the Midwest Pirates Guild. So this was a cracking group, so that they would get the games early and then they would crack them and distribute them on BBSs. And so this was in the episode, most of the stuff that they said was in the episode that was kind of about the underground. But this was super interesting because this is actually like, I grew up in this, like on the edges of this scene. Like, so I wasn't really officially in any of these groups, but I knew all these places and, you know, BBSs and stuff. And it was pretty cool. So I was, I spent much too much time last night, listening to every minute, and taking notes on it, I posted something on Twitter saying, this is great. You know, go listen to this. This is totally delightful. And Jason said, write the metadata basically. So I'm now taking notes on it, but it's pretty interesting. There's some interesting things. There was a BBS that Sinbad ran, and there was they have different user levels, so they were talking about how there was a lot of commitment involved in setting up a BBS because you had to get a dedicated computer, a dedicated phone line. It's expensive, and so there'd be like you, if you wanted to get kind of the advanced user level, you had to pay $5. And so one thing they were talking about was this, there was a, the thing is I remember this, but there was this activity that was supposed to be, you know, a super great thing. And you could learn about it by getting the text files from the like advanced user level. And it was called looting, L-U-D-I-N-G. And it doesn't have anything to do with like drugs, but it was kept, like, there was this mystique, you know, like you, one of the advantages of getting the high user level was to get this, get read about looting. What it turned out to be is crazy. I mean, in a way, because it's so random, but it is essentially going up to like a flagpole and swinging around in a, like around it. It's a physical activity that you do in the wintertime.
What?
It's I don't know. Apparently, so they were describing like when they first started like doing this and before it had a name. And they were essentially saying it was like unbelievably cold and they were bored out of their minds. And so there was a flagpole and so they just started swinging around it. And eventually they gave it a name and then gave it this mystique so that, you know, and apparently that, you know, it became a known activity of things that people would do. You know, there was reports of people in like Florida and stuff doing this and they were sort of dismissing that they were, saying that actually it's better to do in Minnesota because there's like the snow will cushion your fall. but anyway, it was actually, I mean, like, so there was that, but there are also sort of discussions of, there's a quite a famous person called Apple Bandit who was kind of unfortunately he wasn't at the interview. He couldn't make it for whatever reason, but he was kind of the central figure of the group that they were in. And so there's some discussion about like, you know, how he would kind of like, look matrix-like at the code and be able to sort of immediately see what the protection was. And so only a couple of snippets of this actually made it in the real documentary, but I was having a blast. I mean, I'm not sure that everybody would have a blast with this particular thing, but the fact is that a lot of these source interviews are going up, so it's worth taking a look at those.
Nice.
Oh, I guess I was talking about what I was doing. What I was doing was taking notes on this.
Well, you're doing good work if you do actually enter the metadata. That's so right. Thank you for that.
Yeah. No. Well, I was thinking. Yeah. I mean,
someone has to.
And then you know it'll be searchable, and then you know, then we test the statutes of limitations.
Right.
Anyway.
So are you transcribing it? Are you writing it all out? Typing the entire thing?
I am not. I'm.
Oh, it's lazy.
I kind of went through and I wasn't actually transcribing, but I was taking pretty detailed notes, which I have distilled in a couple of stages. So I'm not sure exactly how much detail is going to actually go in. I'll probably send.
It'll say mostly harmless.
Yeah, right. But yeah, I mean, there's some extended discussions of like the Novation AppleCat 2 modem and all the cool things it could do, you know, besides being a modem, which I think people would find interesting to hear about. If they are specifically, particularly in the kind of Apple II scene. But,
mm-hmm.
All right. Oh yeah, actually one other thing that was kind of cool about this this interview stuff was they were talking a little bit about sabotage. Did this game make it into your field of vision at all? It was a game where you have this like little turret at the bottom and you shoot little parachuting, you know, hostiles.
Sounds familiar. I think I know what you're talking mm-hmm. about.
I remember it well. Yeah.
It was a huge thing on the Apple II, okay. And I think it may have gotten ported to the Atari. Mm-hmm. But it's actually on the old sort of like late era but still first form factor iPods mm-hmm. that had video in them. You can get little games for them.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember that. It was on there.
And there was a parachute game in there, which was mm-hmm. basically sabotage. And so this came up in the video because, of course, that was modern tech at the time that the video that Jason shot was being made.
Right.
And I was thinking, wow, I mean, almost nothing else really kind of dates this, but that really does feel like it's already, the interview itself is kind of retro.
Yeah, because that stuff is really old.
Yeah.
Like that iPod line. What's funny is I just Googled sabotage. I totally remember this game, but the Wikipedia thing comes up and it shows the the cover. I'm like, oh, right, this would have been packaged software. I sure had this game. I sure never saw this package.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's Sierra, too, so it's one of those ones that, like, if you're going to get it, it's like $470 or something for this stupid, folder.
Amazing. Yeah, I've never even seen the packaging for this. Yeah. So many games where I'm like, oh, is that what that looked like? Probably didn't even occur to me at the time that it came in a package.
What, you could buy these things?
Because everybody had this game, but I don't think anybody actually purchased it.
Yeah, which is probably why it's worth so much now, because there really weren't very many.
But, right.
Yeah.
You have two of them, don't you?
I don't. I have a couple of things of this. Like, I think I have Wizard and the Princess or something. There's a couple of this very early Sierra things that I have, but I have them by accident. You know, like I got them in some big lot or something like that. Like I couldn't afford to buy them for real.
Yeah, Wizard and the Princess is super early.
Yeah,
like that's even. I think that would even predate Sabotage. Like that's a really early one, isn't it? Look it up. 1980.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's pretty. It's and you know, so those are. If you were to just attempt to buy one on eBay, it's, you know, if you can find it, it's, you know, beyond reasonable.
Yeah, it's one of those ones that's just insane. It's just so silly.
All right. Anyone else have any other things they want to add?
Nope. No.
All right. So maybe I will make it out of here before the apocalypse rains down. I say this, of course, because in my future, the Super Bowl is yet to happen. There's no chance that anyone's listening to this before the result is known. But anyway, all right. I guess that's it for the show, though. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast and join our Facebook group, which is at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send email feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That will help people find the show. And so, until next time.
Whatever.
Yeah, right, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
Retro Compute!
I wonder if we can, you know, cause irritation among the listeners by you know, just never actually saying it.
Until next time, and then just have 5 minutes of silence. Just let them wait.
Yeah.
Ah, yes. That's the way.
Wait, you say until next time, and then you play that whole theme song all the way through, and then Retro Compute.
Actually, don't even, just Retro Compute. Just don't finish it.
Longest, worst outro ever.